Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for November 30, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Kurt Davies, who is the research director at Greenpeace USA, about a suit that several environmental organizations and I think about 10 U.S. states are bringing against the U.S. government, the Environmental Protection Agency, about global warming and its failure to regulate greenhouse gases. And we'll talk to him about that and also some other climate change-related issues. And then at the bottom of the hour, I'll be joined by the editor and a couple of the contributors to the Encyclopedia of Prostitution and Sex Work. Hey, it's work, even if it is sex. The editor, Melissa Hope Ditmore, and two contributors, Jeffrey Escoffier and Joe Weldon, will be joining us. And we'll have a wide-ranging conversation about labor that is... always considered a special category because of residual morality, I guess. And before we get to Kurt Davies and Greenpeace and global warming, let's just review a couple of the economic headlines. This morning, a very surprising increase in first-time claims for unemployment insurance. The U.S. Department of Labor reporting an increase of 34,000 to 357,000. Now, I've been saying for weeks and weeks and weeks that this indicator has been in the low 300,000s on average, which is a pretty good, if not great, level for it to be at. But this rise to 357,000 is out of the good but not great territory into the worrisome territory. Now, there are many problems with seasonally adjusting this data. It's weekly data. It bobs around a lot. The statisticians do try to adjust for seasonal variations and such. And the early occurrence of Thanksgiving Day this year might have be playing some havoc with the data. But it also was up the previous week, 13,000. And the four-week moving average is rising, so this does, if this is sustained and not completely reversed, it does show some degree of concern about what's going on with the job market. The U.S. economy has been slowing down since the beginning of the year. The job market has been slowing somewhat, and some of the forward leader indicators of employment have not been looking so good, but this is starting to show at least some possibility that the job market is softening very significantly. Which is not a surprise if the Federal Reserve, after increasing interest rates 17 consecutive times, you would expect some kind of slowdown. This is what they want. They want a looser labor market, lower wage pressures, and the kind of thing that finance people love, but ordinary workers might not. The Conference Board, its measure of consumer confidence, reported earlier this week down against expectations. Most expectations were for a slight rise. It is down by several points. And interestingly, also, the job market indicators there have been deteriorating. Now, these measures of consumer confidence are doubtful use, except this particular one, the Conference Board's measure, is a pretty reliable indicator of what's going on in the job market, has been for the last couple of decades. In September, more than 5 percentage points gap between those who said jobs were plentiful and those who are saying jobs were hard to get. That is, 26% of the respondents saying jobs were plentiful, 21% were saying jobs were hard to get. That has been narrowing over the last couple of months. It's now down to 3.4% gap. So even though that indicator is still positive, it is positive at a shrinking rate and still well below the levels that we saw in the late 1990s. So further signs of a soft job market there, and also further signs of a softening consumer sector. The International Council on Shopping Centers reporting this morning that stores for chain store sales in the month of November up just 2%, which was under expectations, and continuing a slowing trend in consumer spending. The decline in gas prices was supposed to result in an increase in other kinds of spending. That does not seem to be happening, and we're seeing troubles especially at Walmart. Walmart having its own private melodrama as it tries to go more upscale and enter new markets outside of the rural heartland. But it also is showing that its lower-income customers seem not to be showing much enthusiasm, or at least much desire to spend, despite the decline in gas prices, which is supposed to be, they're the ones who are supposed to be most sensitive to rises and falls in the price of gas, but that's not really showing up in the data. So something is going on. It just seems like a general slowdown in the economy, in the consumer side, on the job side. But also on the corporate side, the Census Bureau reporting earlier in the week that new orders for durable goods, especially capital goods, were down in the month of October. Capital spending, businesses spending, investing in plant and equipment, that seems to be slowing down, which is also what you see when an economy is weakening. So if we see a slowdown on the consumer side, we could hope that businesses would pick up and invest and expand, but that's not happening either. So we're looking at a broadly slowing down in the U.S. economy. And the engine of the U.S. economy over the last several years, I've mentioned over and over again, the housing sector, some mixed signals coming out of that. New house sales down 3% in the month of October. Existing house sales up very, very slightly, 0.5%, the first increase in many, many months. But prices still seem to be falling, and the inventory of unsold houses rising. Both new houses and existing houses. So even though some sign of stability in the housing market, that is not visible across the board. And the Mortgage Bankers Association reporting its measure of new applications for mortgages that down for the second consecutive week, led by refinancing applications down for the second consecutive week as well. So that bounce in the mortgage index suggested perhaps some stabilization in the housing market, but that is no longer the case, at least for the last couple of weeks. And instead of a musical break to bring up the first segment, this is a little gem I discovered on the web the other week. This is our 36th President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, ordering a pair of pants from his tailor. And you can call me juvenile for getting cheap thrills out of vulgar speech and loud public belching by a former occupant of the Oval Office, but I think it's kind of funny. So let's listen to Lyndon Johnson from August 1964.
Y'all made me some real lightweight slacks. Now I need about 6 pairs for summer wear. I want a couple of maybe 3 of the light brown, kind of a almost powder color, like powder on a lady's face. So I need about 6 pairs to wear around in the evening when I come in from work. I want them 1/2 inch larger in the waist than they were before, except I want 2 or 3 inches of stuff left back in there so I can take them up. I vary 10 or 15 pounds a month.
All right.
Now, the pockets, when you sit down in the chair, the knife and your money comes out, so I need it at least another inch in the pockets.
All right.
Yeah. Now, another thing, the crotch down where your nuts hang is always a little too tight. So when you make them up, give me an inch that I can let out there because they cut me. They're just like riding a wire fence. These are almost these are the best that I've had anywhere in the United States. But when I gain a little weight, they cut me under there. So leave me, you never do have much margin there. But see if you can't leave me about it. An inch from where the zipper ends, around under my back to my bunghole. So I can let it out there if I need to.
That was the 36th President of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson, ordering a pair of 6 pairs of pants from his tailor. And I think it's kind of folksy of the president would put on a pair of comfortable slacks after coming home from work and worrying about his knife and his money falling out. You know, I think that's the guy that George Bush is trying to be in some ways, isn't it? We are now joined by Kurt Davies, who is the research director with Greenpeace. Welcome to WBAI, Kurt Davies.
Great. It's great to be here.
So I presume Greenpeace is party to this suit in the several states and several environmental organizations suing the U.S. government to get them to do something about global warming, right?
That's right. Yeah, Greenpeace is one of the founding members of this case, of the founding groups that started it back in 1999. The lead was the International Center for Technology Assessment, but Greenpeace helped it along. And now it's joined by a dozen states, the city of New York, city of Baltimore, American Samoa. And it was the Super Bowl of global warming, really, yesterday. It was quite something.
I'm guessing that American Samoa's particular interest is disappearing under the ocean?
Exactly. I mean, their affidavit says we're very concerned about the threat of rising sea levels as the ice caps melt and as the oceans warm.
Now, of course, from a legal point of view, the question is, do these groups have standing to file such a suit? So review the legal issues for us.
Well, yes. I mean, there are two levels to this, whether they're standing and then whether the agencies have to act. The standing, we think, is pretty solid because we've shown that there is injury occurring already and potentially grave injury to coastlines, to health and welfare of people. And we're very clear in our reading of the Clean Air Act, President Nixon's Clean Air Act in 1970, which names climate as one of the outcomes of air pollution, one of the potential harms of air pollution, and says that the government should remedy that. If we don't pass muster on standing, then the merits of the case don't mean much, you know, whether or not the government should do anything. And several of the judges seem to be headed that way and sort of doubting whether global warming is real. In fact, Judge Scalia was quoted as saying, he misstates the problem and says, well, it's air pollution if we breathe it in, but is it still air pollution in the stratosphere? And the stratosphere really has very little to do with global warming. It's, the air around us and the air up to the troposphere, which is lower. So our attorney says, well, it's not the stratosphere, it's the troposphere. And Scalia says, oh, troposphere, whatever. I'm not
a scientist.
Oh, my
God, really?
Yeah. Whatever. And I'm not a scientist. This is why I don't want to deal with this thing, I think was his quote, which shows you the level of, the level of ignorance and the level of misinformation that rises even up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, Scalia has a reputation for even if being a reactionary. He supposedly has a, pretty high IQ, but it doesn't sound that way from this exchange.
Yeah, he actually said, that's why I don't want to have to deal with global warming, to tell you the truth. You know, he sort of wants to make the issue go away.
Well, I guess he lives far enough inland, so he's not worrying about his ankles getting moist. But those of us who live on Manhattan Island are a little more concerned.
I think that's right.
What exactly is the remedy that the suit seeks to achieve?
Well, the bit about this case that's interesting is that it was started in 1999 when we had really little hope or any hope of getting action on Capitol Hill to solve the problem. So we went to the Clinton administration, who had expressed that they could easily regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act the same way they regulate other gases that come out of our tailpipes of our cars. The reason you go get your car inspected is because of the Clean Air Act. And they had testified that they could do that. And we said, well, kindly then do it. And they drug their heels for a few months. Then it was an election year in 2000. Nothing's going to happen. They got unelected or whatever happened in 2000. We'll decide. And then Bush came in, and
there was a change of personnel.
Exactly. Yeah. And then Bush comes in. We ask them again, kindly, would you regulate carbon dioxide? He then drops out of the Kyoto Protocol, says carbon dioxide is not to be regulated, and they reverse the Clinton decision. So this was born in a different time, really. And the most important thing that comes out of it is that carbon dioxide is declared a pollutant under the law, and that opens the door for many other legal actions.
Does the Clean Air Act specifically name the pollutants that are supposed to be regulated, or just say anything noxious that goes into the air?
No, it names some, but we want carbon dioxide listed and methane and some of these other greenhouse gases listed on that list. That's the basis of this case. And it would basically mean that new cars had to abide by a stricter a rule that EPA would develop to regulate carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. That's already happening in California, and the automakers are suing the state of California to stop them from doing it. So this case bears strongly on whether or not California can help solve global warming, the fifth largest economy in the world.
I was amazed to note the Financial Times has a story today about the EU tightening its regulations on greenhouse gas emissions, and there's a sidebar to it saying the United States may try to stop their efforts to tighten up on restrictions on emissions by airplanes.
It's getting down to brass tacks now. Even though the U.S. dropped out of the treaty, they're still meddling with it, and airplanes are the toughest part, because how do you regulate an Air France plane leaving Kennedy and flying to London full of Americans? Whose responsibility is that plane? Whose emissions? Under the Kyoto Protocol, all emissions will be accounted for in an elaborate system, and then reductions are taken based on that accounting. And airplanes and ships and these so-called bunker fuels, things that travel outside of national borders, that were left out of the treaty intentionally, but they turn out to be a really serious part of global warming pollution.
You know, how big a contribution are airplanes to the whole greenhouse gas problem?
You know, I don't have the percentage in front of me, but the thing about airplanes that's really significant is they're injecting carbon dioxide and water vapor at a very high level in the atmosphere. You know, you're up at 30,000 feet, and it doesn't have much of a chance of sort of rinsing out of the atmosphere. And after 9/11, for example, when the planes were cut off for a number of days and weeks, they actually noticed a difference in the surface temperature of the U.S. because these high-level clouds, the contrails that you see after an airplane goes by, leaves a thin film that actually shades the Earth a little bit. And it's it means that even though their contribution in weight of carbon dioxide and water vapor might not be very large compared to, say, automobiles, it's injected at a very sensitive part of the atmosphere.
All right, let's get back to the Supreme Court case.
Yeah.
So what is likely to happen? What's next? The court has heard arguments. Is the argument phase complete, and now they just have to retreat to their chambers and cogitate on it?
That's exactly right. I mean, it was an hour. All they get is an hour. And it was our lawyers and then the lawyers for the Justice Department. The state of Massachusetts argued it and did an amazing job, an assistant attorney general for the state of Massachusetts, Milky, and the judges, you know, equally badgered our attorneys and the government's attorneys, and it seems like it's pretty split, as most decisions are on the court. And some of it is split on whether or not there's a problem, and some of it is split on the second part of the question, which is that the EPA has the authority to do this under the Clean Air Act. The Bush administration is arguing that they're arguing three different things, both that it's not occurring, that there's no urgency, there's no scientific evidence, and that's why they shouldn't have to act. Then they're arguing that even if they did have to act, the Clean Air Act does not give them authority to do it. And then they third argue, even if we had authority, we have the discretion not to do it. So all three of those arguments have to be gotten over for the Supreme Court to rule totally in our favor. They probably will split somewhere down the middle and argue, you know, something that gives the EPA latitude. But, you know, again, the main thing is if they rule that this is an eligible pollutant under the Clean Air Act, that changes the game. It opens up the opportunity for stuff to happen on Capitol Hill. And there are about a dozen senators vying for global warming champion right now on Capitol Hill.
I should say I'm speaking with Kurt Davies, who is research director with Greenpeace in Washington. I am far from a Supreme Court expert. In fact, I'm rather allergic to Supreme Court stuff. But this is so important, I thought I'd make an exception. My sense is that the court doesn't like to tell the executive branch what to do about major policy issues. What are they likely? They're just likely to shrug their shoulders, essentially, aren't they?
Well, they can do a number of things. I have no idea what's going to happen. I think all of our attorneys felt really confident that it went well, but they don't know the outcome, and we can't predict it, and we don't really want to predict it. But they're likely to turn it back to, I mean, this, you're exactly right. Some of them, it seemed to be arguing, if you read the transcript or listen to it, they seem to be arguing that this is the Congress's responsibility, not the federal government's responsibility, which is kind of the Justice Department's argument, that this is not to be settled by an act of the administration, but should be settled by Congress. But, you know, it could be a number of different things. They could push back to the EPA and say, yes, you do have the authority to regulate, now just do it. They could go back and say, it's not quite clear, but we think this is a problem and there is standing here. You know, it probably won't be settled. It's going to be settled by next summer, but the fallout of the decision either way will take many years.
And what about the EPA itself? So it gets punted into their court. Are they likely to do much of anything? What is the composition of the EPA these days?
Well, that's the thing. They're more likely to be pushed by the Hill at this point, pushed by a new law that's being passed by Congress and put on Bush's lap. I mean, the bigger play right now is that there are going to be dozens of global warming solving bills introduced literally in the first months of this Congress by both sides. McCain has promised to introduce a bill very early on. He got 30-some-odd votes the last time he introduced a bill. Boxer has a great bill. Lautenberg's involved. Lieberman's involved. Everybody is putting forward their 2 cents. Not all those bills deal with cars specifically, but it's a pile-on, and the likelihood that something gets to Bush's pen is higher than it was before November 7th. Now, is that going to be a weak bill? Is that, but ultimately, that bill would then require the EPA to develop regulations under the Clean Air Act in the same exact venue.
So what about this new composition of Congress? Are you encouraged that something might actually happen, or is it just going to be a little posturing that wouldn't really matter in the long run?
Well, the next 2 years are complicated by, you know, not knowing what the administration's response would be, but it's absolutely positive. I mean, from you definitely have a composition of the committees now that can dig into these issues a little bit harder. You get rid of Senator Inhofe, who's still saying that global warming is a lie and a hoax.
The greatest hoax ever perpetrated.
Yes. And he works heavily with organizations that are funded by Exxon that have been deceiving people for a decade or more. With Exxon's money to try to slow this thing down and keep people in the dark about it.
An old friend of my old friend Ron Arnold, I think.
Yes, indeed. He's part of it. Yes. And Myron Ebel and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation and Frontiers of Freedom. There's a whole pile of them. We have a website called ExxonSecrets.org where people can play around and check out the concerted effort that Exxon has put into denial and deception on this issue.
Yeah, there's no good oil company, but Exxon really is struggling to win the bad oil company award, isn't it?
Well, they're just bad on corporate behavior all around, and none of the other corporations like it either. But they epitomize the corporate blockage that in fact has stopped solving global warming considerably. They're very active on the international level. They will double dip and go and lobby China not to join the treaty, and then lobby in the United States that the treaty is not fair because China's not in it. And they try to meddle with the scientific reports. They meddle on Capitol Hill. They set up front groups that say that this is going to cause economic doom and gloom if we pass a law that regulates greenhouse gases. They tried all the tricks, but their arguments are fading, and the momentum and the scientific certainty has sunk in. People get it. There's a giant report coming out in early February in three or four chapters extending through the spring. It's about three phone books thick that's going to lay on all the evidence that we know and all the impacts that are coming. It's very bad news, and we hope that that stimulates the policy arena to get down to business and start solving this problem.
Some of my more radical friends were disappointed in the Stern, Nicholas Stern report that came out in Britain a few weeks ago, but I thought it was interesting that he made the argument that doing nothing has a very substantial economic cost. Has that had any influence on the debate around global warming in Washington?
Yes, that report has resonated strongly. The most important element of that is what you just said, that he's looking at it as that there is a strong impact of not acting, and that the chances of the economic catastrophe caused by the impacts of global warming, the weight of the cost, is so giant that it's worth acting just as an insurance policy to prevent that from occurring. And that's echoed by messages coming out of the reinsurance industry, which insures the insurance companies. They are completely freaked out by the prospect of having to pay off, a Katrina-type disaster every year, or heat waves or floods that are predicted under the most conservative global warming scenarios. In the worst-case scenarios, it sort of overturns the entire global economy. But the positive side of that is the solving of global warming will stimulate technology that will make all of our lives much better. You know, cars that you don't have to fuel up, houses that are cheaper to heat and cool, appliances that are cheaper to run. And, you know, we have a very positive vision of solving this problem that makes our lives easier, that makes transportation more available, makes energy use more efficient, and that generates jobs, and that generates, a new birth of the clean energy revolution, I guess.
Well, you sound optimistic that something can be done. I mean, some of the more gloomier projections make me want to say it's doomed, we're doomed, it's hopeless, there's nothing to be done, it's too late. But you obviously have a more encouraging point of view than that.
Well, you can't say it's too late, because it's not too late to head off the worst of it. It is absolutely too late to solve it entirely. There is a momentum in the system that we can't stop at this point, and carbon dioxide has a 100-year life in the atmosphere, so there's enough carbon dioxide already loaded into the atmosphere that we're going to go through some rough times. But it doesn't mean you don't stop the bleeding now and try to reverse the trend. If, you know, scientists have said we've got about 10 years to really kick into a reducing carbon economy, or we're headed for a higher peak on the bell curve before it comes back down. And the community has been pointing at an average temperature of 2 degrees worldwide, which means the temperature at the poles is going to rise about 10 degrees. The scientists are now saying that, you know, that might even be too much, that that's going to overturn certain equilibriums in the climate and, you know, could lead to some of these tipping point scenarios. It's not good news. I mean, if you've seen Gore's movie, it really is pretty dire. And, you know, Greenpeace has been going on and on about this for 20 years, but it's finally sinking in. And, you know, we just hope we have time, really. And then you think about, who do you blame for slowing us down? And it turns back to Exxon.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but you did mention something about the, I think I had you on here in about September of 2005, talking about the insurance industry.
That's right.
And its role. What's anything new to report in that area?
They've become a little bit more vocal, not enough for the weight of the gravity of the problem, but they're certainly coming forward with the Stern report, with some of these more economic based reports. They're becoming more vocal, but they certainly have a lot to lose, and it'll be interesting to see the response as things go on. What we are seeing is they're just pulling insurance. You know, coastal residents now just can't get the insurance. That's their response, is just to not insure people where they know the risk is, and the risk zones are expanding, the flood zones, and, you know, all of the projections of places that are vulnerable are expanding exponentially as the impacts of global warming occur.
And finally, what about the states? I actually heard Arnold Schwarzenegger sounding like the paragon of enlightenment the other week, saying the states are going to take the lead on climate change issues if Washington won't. What are the states up to?
Well, that ties back to the Supreme Court case, and one of the arguments of the states is that this is a federal responsibility, this is a national and an international problem, and it's not up to the states to solve it. But with the vacuum in D.C., with the Bush administration, the states have really picked it up. And indeed, Schwarzenegger and Pataki, another Republican in New York, have really risen to the challenge and are starting very effective strategies at the state level. California is the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. So in itself, it's a major player in energy use and in emissions. So if it can move, it shows the path and shows other states and other countries how to do it. It also has given confidence to the international arena, to other countries, that things are happening in the U.S., that it's not we're not all deadbeats. So it's all good. And, you know, we hope that translates into good policies with the next president and with this Congress.
Well, I'm sitting on the 10th floor right now, but we're just a few feet from a river. So let's hope they get something done before it starts working its way up Wall Street. Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Kurt Davies, who is a research director with Greenpeace in Washington, D.C. Let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back to talk about sex work. And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the FM dial, and on the web at WBAI.org, where you can not only can listen to us live, but archives of recent programs also there as well. Let's take a musical break, listen to PJ Harvey for a little bit to set up the next spot.
Speak to me of heroin and speed, genocide and suicide, syphilis and greed. To me, the language of love, the language of violence, the language of the heart. This isn't the first time I've asked for money or love. Heaven and earth don't ever mean enough. Speak to me of heroin and speed. Just give me something I can believe. The hard hustle of love.
And that was P.J. Harvey in a little bit of her song, The Whore's Hustle and the Hustler's Whore, which is an appropriate musical introduction to the Encyclopedia of Prostitution and Sex Work, just published by Greenwood, edited by Melissa Hope Ditmore, who is in the studio, along with two contributors to the volume, Jeff Escoffier and Joe Weldon. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
So to start with, why an encyclopedia? Why not just history or some kind of overview monograph? Why an encyclopedia?
I shouldn't tell you the real story, but I'm going to. The reason for an encyclopedia is that Greenwood does encyclopedias, and one of their acquisitions editors grew up in Detroit and was fascinated with pimps and pimp mobiles as a child in Detroit in the 70s. And she was looking for an editor, and the first person she asked sent her to a friend who asked me to be her co-editor.
And the co-editor seems to have disappeared.
She's a contributor and an advisor, but she really didn't have the time to take on the editing.
Uh-huh. So, obviously, we were talking on the way in that everyone focuses on the sex part of it. But it's work, and it involves the exchange of money, and so people don't talk so much about that. But let's talk about the sex part first, because that's what gets everybody going. But I think that's, people think there's something special about sex, and therefore bringing it to the marketplace and exchanging cash for it is somehow violating all its sacred, and that there's, exploitation, all kinds of work, but there's something extra, extra offensive about the exploitation involved in sex work.
Well, it's the combining of the two biggest taboos and the two most loaded elements in our society, and in probably any society, sex and money, they're both extremely powerful.
And hard to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, hard to talk about accurately, for sure.
One of my favorite factoids along those lines is that there's the National Opinion Research Center did a big sex survey in the 90s, and they asked most of the questions face-to-face. The only two questions they asked privately were about masturbation and income.
So mm-hmm.
These are the two things
and
you
I
can't
talk
about. And
I bet they still lied.
Yes, no doubt they did. Well, first of all, let's just describe some of the scope of the encyclopedia. What kinds of articles can readers find in here?
There is Jeffrey's entry on the retrogressive dynamic, describing the sort of reversed income trajectory for people in the sex industry over a long time, where your income starts fairly high relative for an entry-level position, typically, and goes up for a little while, and then typically declines at the end of one's career instead of rising.
Well, yeah, Jeffrey, you want to talk a little bit about that? Because economists talk about the age-wage profile.
Right.
Normally, you start very low in your 20s and peak just before retirement in your late 50s, early 60s, and then it dribbles off as you retire. But that's not for sex workers.
Well, no, and partly a lot of occupations that involve the body and performance have similar profiles. But with sex work, not only just because it involves the body and attractiveness and things that can be, are limited over age, it also involves fantasy. And the fantasy component, the importance of the fantasy component, are one of the things that make it very difficult to sustain over a long period of time, over a career. And, in fact, a lot of things that sex workers do to kind of keep their career or keep their income up is to, dye their hair, change the way they dress. They may even try different activities or develop, sexual skills that they didn't start out with. So those are all things that, it's like human capital, really. Those are all
fantasy
capital.
But yeah. The rate of depreciation is very high in this line of work.
Exactly.
So what is the peak of the earnings curve?
Well, there are not a lot, unfortunately.
I know there are not,
not a lot of rigorous
studies, but what's
here?
Your sense of it?
There are not a lot of good statistics here. It depends who I talk to, and it depends what kind of sex work people do. I am writing a book about the gay porn industry, and I've talked to a lot of gay performers in the porn industry, and their careers last about 3 years. And
so they learn their job very quickly, reach their peak, and then
leave.
It's time for the glue factory.
And there are performers who can last 10 years, and what they do is they reinvent themselves many times over, in terms of what kind of things they perform, what kind of movies they will make, and so on. However, over the long run, it still turns out that they end up doing like per scene, or however you want to measure it, they're making less money at the end of the career than they were making in the beginning of the career. And there's a lot you can do to stretch it out, and you can, if you combine it with things like escorting, which is basically prostitution, if you combine it with stripping, you can make more money. But it's, you have to diversify, basically.
And yeah, where do what happens to sex workers when they retire?
What's the career path like? Talk to that a little bit.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, I always think I'm retired. And it's a little strange for me because when I was young and I was stripping, I actually wasn't at my peak because I had other things very much on my mind. I wasn't concentrated on the job part of it. And one reason that a lot of people enter the industry is not because of the level of income, but because of the level of flexibility and mobility. So income is not the first thing that people choose sex work for. Immediacy of income is one of the primary factors rather than size of income, because if you want to get a job in the sex industry, you can go into an establishment, apply for a job, start the job that night, and have money to pay the bill the next day, and there's no substitute for that in our society. But a lot of people know that they could be making just as much money doing something else, you know, given that if they're not very young and they have no other opportunities, but they want the flexible schedules.
Well, what about the earnings? I mean, I think a lot of people probably assume that strippers or high-end call girls or something make a lot of money. Is it really as lucrative as some people might think?
You know, it depends on the stripper, and it depends on the point in her career. Like, sometimes they'll be very focused, and they'll be making a ton of money, and they'll work at the most demanding club with the highest earning. And then, you know, like right now, there's a club that I'll occasionally work at, like if I have nothing else to do that day. And you can't do this at a high-level club. If I have nothing else to do that day, I'll go in and roll around on the stage for a while and get a little extra cash. And you can't do that. Most clubs would not consider letting you do that, for one thing. I could not go in for 2 months and then just show up.
Well, the retail prices are often very, very high, so who's pocketing all that cash?
Well, in some... Do you want me to talk about this? Okay. There is an issue in a lot of clubs with extremely high stage fees and tip-outs, and this would obviously be the clubs where the women can expect to make the most money, otherwise they wouldn't tolerate it. And when I started dancing in the early 80s, there were no tip-outs except for a 10% tip-out to the DJ, which may or may not have been exploitative, but it really motivated him, so, you know, or her. And then it became, you know, a this or that fee. I remember them charging us a towel fee. I was like, just because you have one shower here for 50 girls where nobody uses the shower, you know, and just one fee after another, one tip out after another.
Hey, laundry services are expensive, right?
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And now in a lot of clubs, you know, in order to work, they walk in owing money in the hundreds. And even in a club where the top dancer and the bottom dancer are two different animals. But even in a club where the top dancer often makes, you know, like $800 a night, if it's a bad night and she only makes $50 and her tip out is $300, she walks into the club the next night owing $550 and the club just pockets it. And a lot of times they'll compare it to a hair salon where you have to pay to have your station. But that's not an apt comparison, because in strip joints, people pay to get in and they buy drinks.
Yes, like cab drivers in New York City start out like $130 in the hole because they have to pay the owner. So it's a very similar business model, but the numbers seem even a little larger if you're talking about starting out $500 in the hole or something.
Yeah.
Well, I think most people assume that the majority of sex workers are female. Is that true, or how diverse is the sex worker population?
Well, I mean, there has always been male sex workers. There are kinds of historical accounts going back to biblical era. I don't think it's easy to say what the proportion is. I think for a very much larger proportion are female. And nowadays there are also transsexual prostitutes, which are a substantial segment in certain cities and places.
That's interesting to bring up, thinking about the transgender sex workers who frequently are sex workers because other businesses will not employ them mm-hmm. in a job situation, particularly in situations where they deal with the public. It seems that all the transgender people who I know are either working in the sex industry or they're in computer programming where they are not in sales, and they're backstage, they're only dealing with the computers and not with the public.
Well, one thing I've always said to guys here is like, you know, because when you work in the sex industry, a lot of men seem to have like sex industry envy. And I've had guys say, oh, if I was a woman, I'd just go around with a mattress strapped to my back. I'm like, dude, get a pager, put out an ad. People will pay you to, you know, you don't need to envy me. Get your groove on. And the guy will say, I'm sorry, I'm not gay. I'm like, well, I'm not straight, so there you are.
That's the voice of Joe Weldon, who is here, along with Jeff Escoffier and Melissa Hope Ditmore, who are contributors and editor of the Encyclopedia of Prostitution and Sex Work, published by Greenwood. And I've got to say, well, the cover is attractive. It looks like a textbook. It doesn't have, it's not sexy looking, which is a little bit disappointing. The shoes are great. Shoes are terrific. Now, those are very eye-catching, and I'm sure that will leap off the library shelves. And,
it looks better than any encyclopedia I remember.
Yeah.
I agree. It's the most photogenic encyclopedia you've ever seen.
It is hot. I'm digging the red crystal shoes. I've got to have them.
Well, I think anytime prostitution and sex work comes up in at least a political or politically progressive context, the issue of exploitation and the old feminist controversy over how evil prostitution is, it's part of the patriarchy. There is an entry, Melissa, you wrote the entry on feminism.
Mm-hmm.
What is the status these days? Is have the McGorkinites lost the war, or are they still around and fighting?
Depends on who you're speaking to. As far as funding restrictions imposed by the U.S. government on international aid to developing countries and federal funding in the U.S. for anti-trafficking and HIV prevention programs, the McDworkinites are in bed with the conservative right, really working this out, setting restrictions that prevent all funds from going to any kind of work with sex workers that could be included or perceived to be promoting legalization of prostitution or any form of the sex industry. However, if you start talking to people on the ground, it's a very small minority of people who actually feel that this should be the case.
Well, it seems that the right's attitude is very much like their attitude about abstinence. You know, you just shouldn't make policy for the world it is. We just pretend that people are just going to say no and then everything will be okay.
It's immensely tied to all the abstinence restrictions. You're very astute to link the two right then.
And apparently there's no scientific evidence that any of this stuff works, but they don't care. Right?
Oh, no, they don't care about that at all. The evidence of their... Well, also, there's a certain kind of circularity to both their logics, which is, you know, it's because it's based on a paradigm of fantasy. It circles in on itself to prove that the fantasy is a real, genuine, valid fantasy. You know, it's an important fantasy to support, even though it can never come true, like this ideal. And I have always been of the opinion, I'm a little less interested in whether or not sex work is feminist. And I'm much more interested in whether or not it's safe for the people who are currently in it than in what benefits they'll get from utopia.
Well, there are some feminists who would argue that this is part and parcel of the patriarchy, that or it's like the business end of the patriarchy, you might call it.
Cuddling up with conservatives isn't.
And if you speak to people who take a feminist analysis of economics, they're very interested in the sex industry as one of the two fields in which women earn more than men, the other being modeling. Things where the body is the cultural capital for which people are paid, and women are judged by their bodies. Here they make the most money over men, which is unique in any industry.
Well, a related way of looking at this is that it's you could say that prostitution is almost part of the apparatus of orthodoxy. I mean, that if you want to maintain monogamy and conventional morality, people need a secret life. they need to get their yayas out, you know, secretly for money. But that would be opposed to kind of a more sexualized version of daily life that would break down the barrier between, you know, the multiplicity or variety in sex and just, you know, openness and daily life. I mean, is it some sense that the flip side of a Victorian morality, that we have a large sex industry?
Where is there not a large sex industry? I mean, I'd have to know more about what's going, you know what I mean? I'd have to look at the culture and the existence of the sex industry in many different countries to determine whether or not that was the case here. Because it seems to me like there's a certain function that the sex industry serves that is not necessarily, some of it's relative to the taboos and some of it isn't, I would say. Like, some of the excitement is that it's taboo, but you get past the taboo, there's a certain comfort level there, a certain charm to it, that it would have whether it was legal or illegal, whether you're doing it openly or not. There's something to it. It does have an inherent charm, I think.
But it also is related back to the fantasy issue, because to some extent when you say people have to have a secret life, you're really talking about, you know, acting out or playing out fantasies that you can't play out with the people like you live your everyday life with, say.
But, or especially if you're a high-profile Christian preacher.
Well, Just to pick a random example.
That's so hot.
Most of the conservative positions are really all hypocritical. They depend on hypocrisy, like the abstinence and, you know, there's no data. They cannot really prove what they're saying, and so they're counting on people to be hypocritical. But you know, the thing is that there's also a taboo for people exploring fantasies.
All of this capitalizes on the difficulty of discussing money and discussing sex. So it's really fun to be on your show talking about both.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been interviewed a lot for research. You know, people will say, so, you know, you've worked in the sex industry, and they always ask me the same questions, and I have yet to have anybody ask me, like, if my parents fought about money in front of me, if I got an allowance, whether I was raised to think that money was more important than relationships. You know, I've never been asked any of those questions by any researcher ever, and I don't think that that's more important than the questions that they're asking, but I can't believe it has never once come up.
Well, I mean, money is in many ways even more taboo than sex, because you can see, well, we have a pornography about money as well as a voyeurism about money, as well as looking at crop shots of Britney on the web, as I've been looking for the last couple of days.
I feel like I missed something.
Oh, yeah, you certainly have. Well,
I was looking at Curbed. That's my porn.
Yeah, well,
apartment porn.
Real estate porn is a big
porn.
Thing in New
York.
What about unionization? There's been some efforts to unionize sex workers, the Lusty Lady in San Francisco, I guess the most famous example of that. How much has gone on, and what are the prospects?
Well, that's the only unionized club, isn't it?
I think so.
They're a member of Local 790 in San Francisco, and I'm not up on their current story. I know that it hasn't been easy for them, but it's difficult to unionize. I'm just going to stick to strippers because at least they're legal, so it's easy to talk about whether or not they could be unionized rather than go into the whole, like, trying to imagine what it would be like to unionize illegal, like, U.S. prostitutes. But basically that flexibility that I talked about is the key. Everybody's quitting next week, and a lot of them do quit next week, or they move, or they don't want to have their real name out there, or they're illegal immigrants. I mean, there's a million reasons that it's difficult to unionize them, including that I don't know that most people in our society have a real positive view of, A, how you get to being unionized, and, B, what happens afterwards.
This is interesting because the International Union of Sex Workers in Great Britain is part of the GMB, which is the largest general union in the UK, and I'm not sure the name of the clubs, but there's a chain of clubs, it may be Spearmint Rhino even, that they are all unionized, and all the people who work there are members of the union, and the laws are different there. So people who work in the sex industry in any aspect, whether it's prostitution, whether it's porn, whether it's stripping, many of them join. Everyone is eligible to join. But the other examples of very successful unions are in Asia and Latin America. In Latin America, the union movement and the feminist movement are extremely tied together, and there are sex workers' unions dating to the 80s and the 70s in Argentina, in Ecuador. There are organizations that work like unions and take a labor perspective, but I don't know if they offer the same benefits as unions in Brazil, meaning health insurance and organizing the same way.
Is there still a black market in those countries?
I'm sure.
Like non-organized workers?
I'm sure.
Joe Weldon, you said that people all say, I'm going to quit next week. Is that just because this is something people will do to pick up, or is there, like, I don't really want to be here for any length of time, or what's
that? Any number of reasons. Like I said, you know, the one place where I drop in every couple weeks, every couple months, they don't even know my name. So to give you an example of just how casual a job it could be. And this is like I hadn't stripped in like 10 years, dropped in on this place. But I would say, nothing again, my mind just drifted off to a little dirty stage.
Why that attitude of I'm quitting next week?
I'm quitting next week. Well, one, they usually have somebody trying to get them to quit for a number of reasons. It might be a jealous lover. It might be a worried parent, you know, that because there aren't benefits. Since it's not unionized, there aren't benefits, and there is a law of diminishing returns. So, you know, that people want to get out of it. And also, one of the problems is when you're burnt out and you're having a hard time in the sex industry, and you could use support where people are like, oh, you'll feel better next week, da da da. People are like, yes, you've got to get out. So you get no support. So you go, okay, I'm quitting next week.
Well, and also, a lot of people, I think, begin to do some kind of sex work as a, they think of it all as a temporary solution to some.
It usually is, too. I don't think that people usually stay in the industry very long. I'm a lifer, but that's my, that's unusual.
Well, I do think that probably 98% of all the people working in the sex industry at any one time are in it for an extremely short period of time.
Yeah, to get an apartment, get a car.
No, it's like one of those distributions where, you know, everything is like, most people, most of it is 99%, and then it's 1%, you know, do all the work.
Actually, we've been using the term sex work and sex worker repeatedly, but I actually learned reading through the encyclopedia that is a controversial term and was actually coined by someone who you can point to and name. So what about that term, sex work?
Sex workers? It was coined by Carol Lee in 79 or 80, and she's a sex worker activist in San Francisco, and she really wanted to emphasize the work part of sex work, as opposed to the sex part that people think of when you use the word prostitution. And one of the things that I like about the term is it encompasses a wide variety of aspects of the industry. So there's stripping and domination and phone sex, and all of this can come under the same rubric, which it doesn't in the term prostitution. So it's often used by people who don't actually want to talk about their specific activities.
And I'm afraid now we're out of time, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was the last voice was that of Melissa Hope Ditmore, who is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Prostitution and Sex Work, just published by Greenwood Press, and she was joined by Joe Weldon and Jeff Escoffier. Thanks for all of you for coming down and into the studio. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this bit from Felix the House Cat, I Am Not Your Cyber Whore.
I am no cyber whore. I am no cyber whore. I am no cyber whore. I am no cyber whore. Yeah.